Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 142 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
It is our enormous pleasure to welcome back Outlander writer Tony Graffia to the Outlander podcast. Tony, good evening. How are you?
Hi, I'm great. I'm great. How are you guys?
Fantastic.
We're great here in Sacramento.
I love Sacramento. I have friends there. It's a great town, and it's our capital.
It is California. That is the truth.
Yeah, last time we were in the thieves' hole. Coming to you from the thieves' hole. Where are we coming from this time? Is it the chess, the library, and the chess game, or?
It's pretty respectfully quiet, so I would say probably the chest of the library.
As long as we're not coming to you from this street where there's
the alley.
The alleyway.
No, we're not coming from the alley. That's a dangerous place.
And there's no one screaming.
From the dinner party. How about
that's true.
That's intriguing. I'm going to go with the dinner party.
Well, no, that means I need to go get like some glasses and start clanging and drinking.
Absolutely. Usually when my episodes air, I try to have like a little gathering with just a few friends, and this season we did a French-themed little party, and everybody brought their assignment was bring like a French dessert, a French cheeses and snacks, and a French wine, and so we actually ended up with quite a French feast for this particular episode to celebrate our season in France.
Well, here's the question. So I know that a lot of actors and mostly actors don't like watching themselves on screen or performing. Do you have the same kind of like Schadenfreude with watching your script on screen, or do you enjoy it?
I would say I enjoy it for the most part. I'm of course very critical when I'm watching the early cuts. When you watch the dailies or sometimes the director's cuts, it's just in such a rough form that it can sometimes make you wince, you know, and go, oh, this isn't, you know, what it was supposed to be, but it's, you have to just remember that it's very rough and that it hasn't had all the magic applied to it, because everyone contributes from the editors to the music, to the sound, to all the special effects aren't in, the coloring is not, the color timing isn't in. So, you know, it's like, beware, watch at your own risk. But by the time it's on TV, I've usually seen it quite a lot of times by then. And I do enjoy watching it. Of course, I will always look at scenes and remember, oh, the line that got cut or this character got cut, or, you know, usually it does happen that I'm missing what I knew was there and could have been good. But I really enjoy watching it with other people. In fact, I'll watch them instead of the show just out of the corner of my eye, because I'm like, oh, good, they laughed at that, or oh, someone's crying now, this is good. But sometimes they're like, huh, what was this? And so then I'm like, oh, yeah, okay, they didn't get that. It's really fun to watch it with people, and I try not to be too squeamish about it, because I love what I do, and I'm very proud of the finished product, and I know all the work that went into it. And usually I watch it and end up going, oh, boy, it was cold that day, especially if I was there when it was shooting, like on this particular one. You know, we're not always there for our episodes. We're there for some of them. And then sometimes someone else will supervise it. But on this particular one, I was there. So I tend to go like, oh, my God, that was a long day. Or, oh, it was raining like cats and dogs that day. And I remember, you know, all the details from the shoot. And that brings it all back like it was yesterday.
In writing, I know in this episode, I don't remember in the other ones you did last season having quite as gratuitous of a love scene as this one did. In the anatomy of writing a love scene like this, how detailed do you get in your scripting? Or is it just kind of like a cue love scene and then you let the director take over?
I mean, we don't choreograph every single moment of it, but we don't just say they make love and leave it up to the director. It's not that of a much of a free-for-all there. This particular one was very important because it was the first time that Claire and Jamie reconnected after, you know, Jamie's trauma. And so we were very conscious of, you know, how important it was going to be. We weren't sure what episode it was going to be in. To be honest, it bounced around a little bit, like, you know, is this too soon or should we wait till later? And at one point it might have been in the third episode, at one point maybe the fifth episode, but somehow we landed on, you know, that was Ron's decision. And I think, you know, we wanted it to feel organic, and it landed in my episode, which I was happy about because I felt it was really satisfying to be able to portray that. It was a big moment, and we knew, you know, there were some discussions about, well, she's pregnant, and, you know, how much do we want to show? But we were all pretty much on board, I would say, that we didn't want to hide, you know, the pregnancy bump or not show a pregnant woman making love, because pregnancy can be very sexy, and we would never hide that. And Kat was very adamant. Katrina really wanted to show, you know, Claire's full, you know, not hide any of that. So the thing that we mostly discussed is where, you know, where it was going to be and how we were going to come to it. And Gary Steele had built this great little nook that was a day bed in the parlor. And we had been walking through the set for weeks, kind of joking that, ooh, this is a cozy little place. We need to have someone make love in there. And at first we thought it was going to be Murtaugh and Suzette, like, oh, they'll have a little romp in there and maybe Claire will, you know, discover them and it'll be scandalous. And then we thought, no, it's really a special place. And maybe instead of Claire and Jamie, you know, making love in the bed for the first time, because we've seen that before, you know, we decided to do it sort of off of this bite that they have, which was, we called the bite mark scene. And then that was in the book where she catches him with the bite marks and he tries to explain in his adorable way that, you know, it's a good thing that he got turned on with this other woman, because it really just sort of jazzed him up to come home to her. She's not in a state to understand at the moment. So we liked the idea of having them have this fight and then him storming off and going to sleep somewhere else, and that she comes to find him. And it was actually Ron Moore's idea that, you know, that we play it in the daybed and have it be, you know, distill it down to its most pure form, which is not a lot of talk, not a lot of action, just, you know, the whole find me in the dark, which was just saying, look, you know, I know you have all these horrific memories of Jack Randall, but let it all go. And I'm not going to try to talk you into anything. I just want you to close your eyes and be in this dark space. And you and I, the chemistry we have, the connection that we have is so powerful that all we need to do is just put our bodies together in this dark place and we will find each other. And that's what we wanted it to be. Not, we didn't even try to make it, quote, sexy, you know, we weren't trying for hotness. We were striving to show connection. And I think we achieved that, and the actors certainly achieved that. And we did give them some direction, but we, you know, we always let them, we trust them. I mean, they're such great actors that you can trust them to add whatever they feel, their characters, most of the time, and they'll give you something surprising, and they'll build on whatever the script is. So we were very pleased with how that scene came out, and we know the fans have been waiting a long time going, when are they going to get back together? But we wanted to do it right. We felt it was a huge responsibility after showing, you know, the rapes from last season, not to just have them hopping into bed together and it being such an easy fix. We wanted them to have to find their way back to each other. And by the way, it doesn't mean that he's cured or that it all goes away because they made love one time. It's just sort of the beginning of the healing for them. It was a step in that direction.
What attracted you to this episode or this part of the story? And did you have to fight for it?
For the episode in general or that scene?
Either or both.
I would say the episode in general, no, you know, in every season there's kind of one episode that, you know, after you read the book that maybe you're dying to write. And last year for me it was The Witch Trial, which is what, you know, I talked to you guys about. When I read Outlander, it was like, absolutely, I must write, you know, The Witch Trial. I loved it. I loved it even more than The Wedding. And Kenny did a great job on The Wedding, but it wasn't an episode I ever wanted to write, even though I know it was a popular one. I always wanted to write The Witch Trial. And luckily I got that one. And actually I said, you know, I remember in the beginning of last season going, okay, if I have to do the Rent episode, I'll do it just so I get The Witch Trial. I wasn't really crazy about having to write the guys on the road. I felt a little nervous about that because it was such a male-oriented episode, all the dudes on the road, you know. So I kind of thought, if I can get through this one, I can get to the one I really want to write. But then what happens is, you know, with writing, as usual, is whatever episode you're writing, you kind of fall in love with it while you're writing it. and what you thought became this sort of like road episode, you find the things to love and the sparkling jewels in that segment of the story, and then you do, you know, your best job on it. But that was a very hard episode to write, the Ren episode. And this year it was sort of the same thing, and I can't really tell you which one, but there's one in the middle that I did write that was the one when I read Dragonfly that I was like, I'm dying to write this episode. This one I have to write. But I knew I had to take an earlier one too. So it was like, I don't really care which one I get in the beginning, you know, throw one at me, but I have to have this one, which will be my next episode. And you'll see it in upcoming. But when it turned out to be the dinner party episode, I have to say, I felt about the same as I did with the Rent episode. I was like, oh, great. A dinner party. That's fantastic. What am I going to do with a dinner party, you know? But yet, the same as the Rent episode, by the time I was working on it, I fell in love with it because I realized it had all these amazing parts. You know, I love Master Raymond and the Bones, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. And I loved, you know, there was a lot to love in it. It ended up being a very juicy, very sort of dangerous liaisons type of sexual intrigue, political intrigue all tied together. And I loved writing Sandringham. And so to answer, you know, to come back around to your question, it was not an episode I fought for or wanted. It was the one that I wanted to just get out of the way so I could do the one I really wanted. But then once I did it, I did love it and was proud of it. And, you know, it was a nice first one to have to kick off the season, and quite different from the next one that I wrote, which you'll see all the ways in which it's a completely different episode. Yeah, so the dinner party. But a lot of the reviews that I've been reading, and I do read reviews, not all the writers do, but the reviews all tell, wow, so much happened. Like, some even turn it into a negative, like, too much happened, you know? Like, they crammed too much in there, and it didn't have really room to breathe the way some people wanted. And it's true, I do tend to write really dense scripts where a lot happens. And I like that. I mean, I like that. I like for things to have room to breathe too, but I still feel like we did have scenes in there that breathed. But, you know, when you watch it, you do go, wow, there was a lot. There was a lot. There was a dinner party. There was another rape. There was, you know, I got to show the hospital. We had Fergus and Murtaugh. You know, we had the Compt in there. It was a lot. And I like that because, like, for instance, I really love Mother Hildegard, and at first it was like, wow, will we have room for a hospital scene? I hope so, because I love Mother Hildegard, and I love the actress, and Frances de la Tour, I'm like, I have to have her in my episode. So I kind of, we don't always go in linear fashion in the book or pull from chapters that are all in a row. Sometimes we pull from different parts, and I think I look through the surrounding chapters and thought, what can I take from the hospital that will fit into this episode? Because I really want, you know, a scene in the hospital, and I want to see Bhutan, and I want to see, you know, Fergus. And so I think this episode it's like my next episode is pretty much only about one thing. This episode had like 10 different things in it, and we just threw in everything but the kitchen sink, and it was just a lot of fun, I think.
Well, you couldn't have known it when you were writing it, but literally all you had to do was write a scene or an entire episode with Kat and Stanley sitting next to each other and smoldering, and that would have made your entire episode.
Oh, yeah, they're great together. The Compty's really scary. It's very funny because in person, he's not that scary. He's a very nice guy, but on screen, you know, he really sends a little chill up your spine. And his name is Stanley Weber, so it doesn't sound very French. And we had some actors that weren't French. We had some that were, you know, British, and they spoke French, or they had a great French accent for their English lines. And we would go back and forth how many scenes we wanted to be in French. And sometimes at the last minute, we would change an English scene into French, or vice versa, and we'd always have to go and let them know and be like, the bad news is you're going to be up all night learning this French because we just switched the whole scene to French, and here's the translation, you got to learn it. And I remember having to go to his trailer. They said, bring Stanley this scene and tell him it's all in French now. And I went, you know, with my tail between my legs and knocked on his door and was like apologizing to him that at the last minute we were throwing him this curveball. He was going to have to learn this whole scene in French. And he like just grinned and rattled off this French answer to me in perfect French. And then I just totally blushed and went, Oh my God, you are French. I should have known, but I was just so tired and so busy that I'd forgotten.
That's delightful.
And he said, yeah, I think I can manage to do the French by tomorrow. He was wonderful, a lovely guy. And I love that. I could just watch that scene forever. The way he's even eating, like popping those cherries or whatever in his mouth and looking at, you know.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, I don't know if you noticed that his wife was there sitting across from him. That was something funny when I was trying to work out who was going to be at this dinner party. And I've told this story before that we had to call Gary Steele and say, how many people can fit at this table? It's a table for 16, but we couldn't fit 8 men and 8 women because the costumes were so wide. The dresses were so big that we couldn't fit all the women at the table. So we had like a literal dress rehearsal where we just dressed extras in the dresses to see how many we could fit. And I think we worked out that we could fit because I wanted as many people as possible. And I think we fit like 4 women and 12 men. Some of the men brought, male, guests with them, like the general brought his aide and, but we were like, who does the comp come with? And I was like, I found this thing that said his pretty wife. So I put it in the script and I said, the comp's pretty wife, shows up and he's a surprise guest. And then, I hope she never doesn't mind that I tell this story, but Diana sent a note and she's like, the comp doesn't have a wife. And I was like, I wrote back and I said, yes, he does, actually. You wrote it. And she wrote back laughing. She was a good sport about it. She goes, oh my gosh, I forgot. I wrote it, but I forgot that he had a wife. Because it was literally only one line, I think, in the book where it said something about the comp and his pretty wife. And I was like, well, you've only written, 8 of these books that are like 1,000 pages each, and you wrote them like 10 and 15 years ago, whatever. And so I don't, of course you don't remember, but I thought that was really cool that he had a pretty wife. And we threw her into the dinner party just for an added layer of intrigue. And we had many conversations about does she know what a bad guy he is? Or is she just this little innocent arm candy? Or does she know that he hates Claire and what she did to his ship? And we sort of decided that she did know. And the actress did a good job of sort of acting very sly and portraying like she was kind of in on it. She wasn't just arm candy. And I like that. And I loved reading when we released the pictures ahead of the episode saying, oh, here's some pictures for the coming season. And they were at the dinner table. All the blogs and all the, Twitter people were trying to, who is that woman? Who is she? And no one guessed that it was the comp's wife. So I was kind of tickled a little bit about that. Like, oh, they're going to be so, interested when they see the episode and they realize exactly who she is, because a lot of people probably don't remember that one line in the book where they talk about his wife.
Well, a lot of us, when we read it, didn't imagine the comp being a sexy, virile man. So we prefer him single. So when you brought a woman to the table, we were a little disappointed.
I get it. Well, all the girls on the set were, very, very, giggly when he came around. He's just really really cute guy, as is the king of France. He's also a very, very cute guy. And it was just like, wow, all these French accents and all these cute guys and all these beautiful women. It was, it's just been a really awesome season to see these different colors and the different sets and costumes and the different accents. It's just been a breath of fresh air from Scotland, which we love, and we will get back to in later episodes. But I think that's what's going to keep the show, alive for a long time, we hope, is that each book is completely different and each season will be different in a different location with different characters, and the show continually reinvents itself, which is awesome. And that way we still keep the people we love, but we see them in different settings. And that's why, I think I wrote the line where Duke of Sandringham says to Jamie something like, you're a stunning, man in any setting or something, because Jamie can go from being covered with mud or blood or whatever in the Scottish Highlands and then just look, devastatingly handsome, in this French manner. So it's great to get to see them, in all these different facets.
So speaking of French, the language, was it a choice? Because we've been noticing that Stanley Weber has spoken almost completely French from the first episode up until this current episode where he actually spoke English. This was the first English we've heard him speak. Was that a choice or was that just...
Well, it was very much a choice. There was a plan, basically, for him to speak only French until a certain moment in the season, which is actually coming later. Which is also in an episode that I wrote, but in this particular episode, we did let him speak a little bit of English because we thought if he's talking to the prince and he's trying to get in good with the prince, he does it kind of as a, you know, F you to Jamie and to the people around him that he has, you know, disdain for. He like, I can't be bothered to speak English for you. You just have to understand my French. But we thought that, you know, we thought it would be inappropriate and rude that in front of the prince, even though the prince speaks French, that if the prince is speaking English to him, if he wants to get on the prince's good side, he just has a couple of lines of English to show deference for the friend, for you know, the prince. And then he turns and says, summon the gendarmes in French. I was a little kind of torn about that because I really didn't want to hear him speak any English until this moment later in the season when it's really appropriate and necessary that he speak English. So we kind of spoiled that a little here. I was hoping no one would notice that, but of course nothing gets past you girls. but I think it's okay. I think you're still left with he speaks, you know, mostly French. And then when he does speak a lot more English, it'll be rather shocking and you'll know why when it comes.
So you've mentioned a few times this other episode that's coming up that you're writing. Now, without talking about the actual episode, it's number 7, Faith, correct?
No comment.
No comment. Okay, so we will...
I think I'm not supposed to say who wrote what episodes, although I think it's been already publicized that Matt Roberts and I did co-write the finale together this season.
Oh, okay.
That's already been in the press. Yeah, I can confirm that, but otherwise I can't really say... Otherwise, I can't say who wrote what episode. You'll just have to keep watching.
We'll have to wait. No problem. That comes from IMDb, yeah. So that's why we're asking.
Yeah, that's funny how they get a hold of, I don't know, once in a while I'll see, you know, titles released. Like at first they didn't release any titles, and then suddenly they had the first 4 titles, or then suddenly they had the whole season titles, and then they didn't have the writers, and then slowly the writers leak, you know. But I think, you know, everything should be a surprise. It's better if it's a surprise.
In season 1, there were certain scenes we were sad to lose or to not have included. We let go of it as huge book fans because we were looking at the show as an adaptation, as it is, and it is a work of its own merit. Thus, it was a joy to see certain things, especially in 204, that are beloved from book 1. For example, the fortress, the blade of grass speech.
Mm-hmm.
So going into writing this episode, now that we know that it was the one that you did because so you could get to the one that you wanted, but still going into it, once you were starting your game plan, did you know that you wanted to incorporate this or other things? Because there was a whole, one of the things I said in our podcast about this episode was that not only we get great scenes and like whole dialogue, whole speeches from what we thought we were missing, but so much, that's from Outlander, but so much that was in 204 is straight from Dragonfly and Ember. I mean, this is, to me, the richest book episode thus far.
I would say a lot of the plot follows the book because those were, you know, popular parts of the book. Everyone, the dinner party, the Mary Hawkins, the whole Alex Randall of it all, you know, that stuff from the book. There was some stuff that wasn't from the book, like Fergus and Murtaugh, which was a great little scene. Actually, Matt Roberts pitched that scene. He loves Murtaugh, and it was the only one that wasn't really necessary for the plot. And usually sometimes those get edited out if it's not absolutely necessary to explain the story or to make the plot move forward. A lot of times if an episode is too long, they'll cut those out. And that was one scene that it wasn't really necessary, but everyone loved it so much that... that there was no way we could cut it because Fergus and Murtaugh were great together. But definitely, I would say, I mean, we use things in different ways. Like, I think they discuss baby names in the book, but it's in a different it's in a different way. We like purposely, you know, open the show with the baby names during the chest so that it's almost becomes part of their fight, because here's Claire trying to involve him in the whole pregnancy and the planning for the baby, and he's so distracted and you know, caught up in his, you know, the Jack Randall of everything and the you know, the Paris and trying to stop the rebellion, that he sort of has lost sight of that they're having a child together. And so we wanted to use the baby names. It's like they might have baby names in the book, but it wasn't used in this way. So we do a lot of times use stuff from the books, but use it in our own way to make the TV show work. The Fortress speech was actually not planned at all for this episode. And I have to credit Merrill Davis, our amazing producer with that, and Ron's partner in Tallship, is that, you know, she's a real book lover, loves everything, knows all the books really, really well. She's our touchstone that we always, you know, will say, well, you know, you can't do this here because it plays in a later book, or you got to be careful because if you mess this up, it'll mess up a later book, because she has it all in her head for the most part. And she had come to me and said, you know, there was something I really loved in the first book that we never got to do, either for time or just didn't organically fit in the place that it was supposed to. And she goes, I'm sorry we lost it. And she's a fan, and she knew the fans missed it. So she said, you know, there's this Fortress speech, and if there's any way to work it in, I just love it so much. And I went, yeah, I'll look at it. And then, you know, when I went back and found it in the book, I was like, I think she may have even forwarded it to me. It was like, here, you know, try to use this. And when I saw it, I was like, oh my gosh, it's perfect. It's perfect for this scene. And, you know, it did fit really well here. And I was sort of proud of the way we used it, because, you know, one of the early reviews that came out, and we send the reviewers sometimes several episodes to watch, not just the premiere of the new season, but one of the first reviews said, wow, there was something I was really pissed off that they didn't use the first season, but when I watched this, you know, several episodes in, they use it, and it's even better where it is than where it was. So I'm happy, and I have to eat my words. And when I saw that, I was like, first I was like, what could he be talking about? I wonder what it is. And it was driving all the writers crazy, like, what is it? And then later I went, oh, I bet I know what it is. Got to be the blade of grass speech, because we did all love that. And, you know, we hate to lose anything that's a fan favorite or that is our favorite. But, you know, sometimes we have to, but sometimes it's like, be patient and we'll work it in somewhere, because the good stuff always comes back. I mean, there's a speech that I love in the first book where Jamie gives, I'm winging this now here because I don't remember it exactly, but it's something about the trees and how he knows when it's going to rain, because he has this beautiful speech where he says, I know these trees, I've been around them for years, and I know the color, you know, I know that when the leaves turn pale or when the leaves upturn towards the sky, it means it's going to rain, because I know these trees so well. And I call it the tree speech, and I loved it. I tried to get it in like two different episodes and it just didn't fit or came out for whatever reason, but it's in the back of my head. I mean, if I remember it for this long, then there's a reason, and that I'm still determined to sneak it into an episode somewhere. And in five, someone will go, hey, that was back in book one, and I'll go, you're damn right it was, and I remembered it, and I was going to put it in somewhere if it killed me.
Oh, so I my think goodness. The fans,
you know, I hope that we've earned, you know, your trust by now, that if there's stuff that's great, we will try to get it in there, and that sometimes there's stuff we make up that's not in the book where people will go, God, I love that starling thing, you know, and I'm really glad you got that in from the book. And then I'll go like, actually, that wasn't in the book. We put that in. I put that in, but I don't know that I did my job right if someone thinks it's from the book, because I do try to keep it in the same, you know, the same flavor that Diana writes, so that it doesn't stick out like a sore thumb, like, oh, some stupid TV writer wrote that, you know. Don't mean to call TV writers stupid, but you know what I mean? There's some network TV that tends to be very cookie cutter. And we try to, and not that those shows can't be great, because I sit up all night watching reruns of shows that are considered cookie cutter shows, but there's a reason, because you like those cookies. And when you're in the mood for that cookie, you go to the cookie cutter show, because that's what you want. That's what you're in the mood for. But on this show, we try, you know, even though we're adapting the book, we want to come up with some, you know, material of our own that will fit seamlessly in the thing that we're tasked with adapting. And we like it when the fans, you know, sometimes can't tell the difference, because that means, too, that we've done our job. And I think Diana is tickled by that, too, because she knows that that means that she inspired us to be creative and not just, you know, we're not transcribers trying to transcribe the book. We're inspired by her writing, and hopefully it makes us reach into our creative depths and do something that will complement her work as beautifully as she did the original.
I think you gave some beautiful examples of how it absolutely does that. And when someone says, oh, I'm so glad you included that from the book, and it actually was from your own heart and mind,
yeah,
you know, that is, I can see that being the biggest compliment ever.
Yeah, for sure.
And we do a read-along going up to, so we're pretty current with the books as the season starts. So if we see something where we're like, wait, did that happen in the book? And we have to go back, that's high praise indeed, so... I loved the starlings. I like starlings anyway. We have there's a murmuring of them in Sacramento, actually, that used to be over by Target, and it scared the crap out of me because I was afraid they're gonna poop on me every time I got out of my car, because there was that many of them.
Oh wow, yeah, I had actually never heard of it before, and I just found them when I was like, I think it was like a YouTube of the day or something when I was procrastinating from writing, and I. clicked over and was watching some YouTube videos, and I saw that, and I was like, that's fantastic, you know, I have to use it somewhere, maybe I'll use it right now. And when I looked it up and saw what it was and the meaning, it was just too serendipitous to pass up, because it had the meaning of, you know, birds of a feather flocking together for protection against the attacking of the hawks. And I thought, this is exactly them, you know, what the predicament they're in. So I used it, and Alicia Bissett, our post-production supervisor, and Mikey O'Halloran, our editor, they searched far and wide and found these amazing shots of the starlings to use for the title card, and I used it in the script, and I love it, and that's one of the it's one of my favorite things of that I've done for Outlander so far. I hope I can top that. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I can. I'll have to write a few more, but we'll see. But there is some really great stuff coming. I think you guys are not going to be disappointed. I know people have different favorite books, you know, and some people love Voyager, and some people love, you know, Dragonfly, and there's a lot of debate. I love both of them. I'd say I love Dragonfly is a favorite of mine, but it's not going to let up. You know, the first few episodes were great out of the gate, but it only gets more exciting, more emotional, just ramps up from where we are now. And I think it's going to be breathless. And I think by the end of the season, it's going to be exhausting. And I think everyone's going to be really happy. I mean, there are shows I watch that I go, wow, how are they ever going to top that? That was a great season. And then, you know, a good show, you just can't believe it, but you watch it in every season. You go, wow, that season was even better. How did they do that? And it's shocking, because very few shows can do that. And that's our goal. You know, I hope that as we continue, we never run out of steam, and we're, you know, that people will go, keep going, wow, how did they top that? How did they top that? Well, now what are they going to do next? Because there's a lot of rich material to come, and I'm eager to hear what you guys think about it. It means a lot to us.
Well, speaking of title cards, we were discussing between ourselves about what he's doing to the carriage wheel. He is sabotaging. Sabotaging the wheel. Now, I didn't notice it the first time through, but technically I noticed it the third time through, because somebody had to tell me about it. But the person who is sabotaging the wheel has the mark on his hand.
Right.
Which comes back later in the alley scene. And what I remember from reading the book was that this gentleman was said to have some sort of a mole or a beauty mark. And my contention with that was the idea that it was potentially such a small thing that somebody would not notice it from across the room, as she is supposed to later in the book. So I was actually quite pleased to see that it was switched with a large port wine stain birthmark.
Right, right. I'll tell you a little secret. I actually didn't notice that in the title card. Matt Roberts shoots some of the title cards. He does some second unit directing. And I think it was even his idea for that title card. Usually the title card has something to do with the episode, but Ron's rule had always been, it can't be an actual scene or a clip from the episode. It's not something we want to see again, or at least not in the same way. So usually the title cards are, you know, something that applies to the episode, you know, but is related to the episode, but it's not exactly a clip from the episode. But, you know, after a while, the title cards, we don't want them to get predictable either. So this was where we kind of broke out of the mold, and I think it was either Matt that pitched it or Ron, or we were all in a room, and the idea came out that, like, let's try to, you know, it was the first time it'd be like, let's do part of the story in the title card and show something that people go, huh, what is that? And then later when they see that the carriage is sabotaged, they'll go, oh, that's what it was happening. So I knew that that was shot, and I saw it in dailies probably, but I didn't even notice, you know, probably too busy looking at my name. Because, you know, writers are watching and they're just like, okay, where's my name? Where's my credit? For instance, I love my credit in the opening of being over the king walking. It was a great, beautiful shot. But I didn't notice the stain, the port wine stain there. And then only when I read reviews of the episode, people were like, hey, that's the same beauty mark. And I was like, oh, God, I didn't even notice that. But yes, it's there. How clever. It wasn't me that thought of it. I believe it was Matt Roberts. And actually, in the book, it is described not as a mole. I believe it was a beauty mark is what they said. And then we ended up Googling because the question came up when we were going to do the makeup for it. And Annie McEwen, our makeup artist, she was the head of the hair and makeup department, actually was like, now, what do you want here? What do you consider a beauty mark? Can it be a brown mole type of thing? Because that's considered a beauty mark. But it also, she was the one that suggested port wine stain because I think we did some camera tests and we used, you know, a hand where we put various different marks on it. And you're right. If it was like a brown sort of mole, more not a raised mole, but like a flat looking brown spot, it just looked like someone had drawn with a brown pen or it was hard to tell what it was. And I think she suggested port wine stain because those are so, you know, those are just so visually striking. It's something you would remember. And she did a few tests where she brought pictures to us and said, what do you think of this? And maybe we adjusted it slightly, made it smaller or bigger, but it was definitely, you know, something that you would remember. And so we did switch it up a little bit because in the book it doesn't say port wine stain, but I don't know if that's what they called them back then because technically anything that is like that is considered a quote beauty mark. So we were kind of just, you know, fudging a little bit with what different cultures call different marks on people. But I think it was successful. But of course, you know, when you're fighting in the dark alley at night, you know, if you get sweaty or if someone grabs your hand and it's makeup and not a real one, it can rub off a little. So I know they just had to keep readjusting it and taking pictures of it to make sure it stayed the same and it looked right. And she did a great job. I think it looks very striking, and I think it's great that it was in the, you know, in the opening credits. And that's the one and only time, I believe, this whole season that there is a credit, you know, an opening title card that is, quote, part of the story. Although we do have another unique, I can tease this, I can't say what it is, but there is a very unique title card coming towards the end of the season that I think you guys will enjoy a lot. Keep an eye out for that one. See, you're getting all the scoop from talking to me here.
I guess I'll just have to watch all the episodes now.
Oh, darn
yeah,
it.
Yeah, you'll have to, in case you were planning on missing any of them.
Darn it. That's just, now you're just like, you're ruining my month now, Tony. I'm just kidding. Okay, so Master Raymond. We all loved the reveal of his apothecary shop. John Gary Steele did a crazy, beautiful
Great job.
And Terry with Master Raymond's, wardrobe, the hints at the occult, and everywhere you look, it's everything is woven in. And if you don't know anything about the show, or the books, excuse me, then it's just eye candy. It's beautiful. But if you do know about the show, there's so much you can, you know, like pick out, which is, if you know about the books. Yeah. And so a few questions about Master Raymond. So in an earlier episode, when Master Raymond's telling Claire all about the bitter cascara,
and how he'd sell it to people who wanted to use poison, actually. Now, he is telling her this because she asks about the monkshood, but he goes to quite a lengthy explanation. So do you think that this is purely educational because he knows she's a healer as well and she asked a question? Or do you think that because, as we learned in 204, he's only sold it to one person and it was a servant and he didn't recognize the person? So do you think that his quote-unquote education, what he told her, was to later serve as sort of a warning in hindsight?
No, that definitely is not the case. I can see where in hindsight, it looks kind of like that, but we didn't have that in mind when we wrote those two scenes. He didn't know at the time that was meant for her, and he wasn't, you know, trying to give her a hint like, hey, if you get poisoned, you know, don't worry, it's not fatal. I think he likes her. He sees something special in her. He doesn't know that she's from the future necessarily, but he sort of suspects it, and that's why he's, you know, he has that great line where he says, I'm fascinated by things not of this time. He suspects something, and I don't think he knows for sure, but he likes her, and he admires that she's a healer, and she's unique in that she's this woman that seems to know a lot. And I think, you know, in the first scene, even though that wasn't in my episode, I know from, you know, discussions in the writer's room that, and from what came from the book, that she's just shocked to find poison on his shelf. And basically, he's letting her know that he's not a bad guy, that he would never sell poison to anyone. And he's kind of letting her in behind the curtain. He's kind of like the Wizard of Oz, you know, and saying, you know, don't worry. I know that not a lot of people know this. You're a healer, so you spotted the poison. But I'm going to let you in on a little secret. It's not poison. And we used to joke in the writer's room that he was like, yeah, humanitarian. You know, he's an equal opportunity poisoner because he's not going to really kill anyone, and that he's a smart enough guy to know that when people come and buy poison because they're angry at someone, it cools off. And maybe they buy poison intending to kill someone, and it messes up the person just enough to make the poisoner feel like they've gotten their revenge because the person gets really sick. But by that time, their anger has cooled off and they're kind of glad the person didn't actually die. So I think he's just letting Claire know, hey, I'm not a bad guy, because he likes her and he wants to be friends. And then when it happens, I think he's truly shocked. Like he really didn't know who was trying to poison her. And he wants her to know that, because otherwise she would hate him. And he doesn't want to lose her as a friend because she's like a kindred spirit to him. And so, you know, but we like having the confrontation where she's like, hey, if I got sick off of this, I know it came from you. So you must know who did it. And she's especially suspicious because she saw him the week before with the Comte, you know. And he said the Comte wasn't his friend, and then she saw them together. So she's very suspicious. And he's like, I can see why you're suspicious, but I promise I really, truly don't know who this is. And that's why he gives her but he knows once that happens, he knows, oh, someone's after her. And he gives her the stone at the end, the crystal, to protect her, because he truly does like her and want to protect her. You know, of course, that could figure in later episodes. And we see it at the dinner table, and we see that the Comte doesn't know what that is. You know, when he says, it's not merely a necklace, I know what that is. And they have their little exchange about, if you don't trust the cooks in your own kitchen, you know, perhaps we should all wear stones. And she's like, perhaps you should.
That was a really good point, though, that he made. Because if the host of your dinner party is wearing something to show whether or not she's being poisoned, why should anybody be eating at that table?
Right. That was a very last-minute addition, I remember. That was a last-minute, and it came in one of the later script revisions, that we wanted that little exchange. And we had this wonderful guy, Guillaume, actually, I have to believe his last name is Lecomte, Guillaume Lecomte, who was our French translator, and he was on the set with us at all times. He put he was the one that did the translations into the script. We would write them in English, and he would put them in French, and he would be on the set to help the actors with pronunciation. And occasionally there would be a line or two here or there that just didn't have a French French translation. Now, most of the time he would do it word for word, and we're very picky and, you know, particular, and we'd say, we want it to be exactly this. And sometimes he would translate it, and we'd say, well, what is that in French? And then he would say it, and it wouldn't be exactly the same. And we'd go, no, 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 that's a watered-down version. We want it to be exactly this. And we would push him to get as close as possible. But once in a while, he would say, I'm sorry, there's just not a French word for this, or there's not a way to say this in French. We wouldn't say it like this. And occasionally we had to take some liberties with French to say, you know, because when you're watching movies with subtitles, I mean, I know Italian. I'm not fluent, but I know a lot of Italian. And when I'm playing movies, I'm like, wait a minute, that's nothing like what they just said. And I realized that even in movies, big movies, translations are very loose when they do those. So I thought, why are we going to kill ourselves to do a perfect translation? What we really need to be imparted here is the gist of it. And I think that's one of those translations, if I'm remembering right, where on the set we wanted Claire to say, perhaps you should. Like, yeah, you think you should all be wearing stone? Yeah, maybe you should, because maybe I'm trying to poison you, you know, right now, like you did me. You know, we wanted it to be touche is what we wanted it to be. And I remember, you know, having to discuss that a lot with Guillaume, because it was like, there's not a French translation for perhaps you should, you know. But I said, you know what, just get it as close as you can, and the subtitle is going to say perhaps you should, even if it doesn't match exactly, because that's the only way to put it in English so that we know that Claire is, you know, sticking him back with this jab. So, and incidentally, her Guillaume does play a small role. He had a little cameo in a coming episode, which I realized is also down the road, so I can't say, but perhaps we'll meet again, and then I'll be able to tell you, oh, this is who he is, because he was really helpful. We have a lot of great people helping us on the set. We have Carol, who does our Scottish dialect, so that, you know, we write a lot of everything we write. If we need to put, and a lot of us now from being in Scotland and from doing so much research, kind of know Scottish buzzwords and a little bit of Scottish slang and, you know, colloquial Highland talk, and we'll put it in there. But when we don't get it exactly right, she'll go over the script and help just tweak things a bit to make it sound very Scottish. And she's a great help. And she also plays a small cameo in a coming script. And we have Danny, who did all our historical research and helped us in, especially in the dinner party, with, you know, where people would sit, you know, which courses would come out when. She told us very interesting things, such as, you know, it wasn't like Downton Abbey, for instance, where the English were very formal, you know, during that time, and they'd have the courses come out one by one, and the waiter, you know, the servants would bring out one course and clear it completely away and then serve the next course. She told us this really cool thing, which is that the French were much more into pleasure, and, you know, they just brought all the food out at once, basically, and set it all down, and it was more like a free-for-all of everyone just enjoying the food. And I think we still did a little bit of coursework, because the director really wanted to get those beautiful long table shots that he did of the food coming out. But ultimately, we didn't ever clear it all away. We left it all on the table because the French are just a little more decadent. And I thought that was a really cool historical detail that they just, you know, put all the food out and you just ate whatever you want. I thought that was great.
Now, back in Master Raymond's apothecary in the back room, when he is throwing or using the oracle bones, was that meant, or could one correctly see, if one wanted to, a parallel to Mrs. Graham?
Yeah, actually, yes. Now that you mention it, it kind of is like, you know, she was reading tea leaves. You know, I mean, back then, people very much believed in magic, magical thinking like that. She read tea leaves, and he read the bones. I can tell you that in the original draft of the script, I had him do her astrological chart. He was into astrology, and that he asked her birthday, and then he did like a little reading where actually he was very confused and kind of looks up at her with a cocked brow and said like, are you sure this is when you were born? Because this chart isn't adding up, which is great because she wasn't born in the year that she claims to be, because of course she was born, you know, she's a woman from the 40s, but she has to pretend that she was born in the 1700s. So when she tells him her birth date, which I think is October, oh, I hope I don't get this wrong. think she has an October birth date. Claire does. But it's, you know, she tells him the wrong year. And in the scene, he says, this doesn't add up. Your chart makes no sense. And she's like nervous because, of course, she is lying. And, you know, we liked it. It was a cool scene. But at the same time, astrology is so ubiquitous that it was actually Ron who said, you know, let's try to find something a little more unique than astrology. And he had read something or knew something about it. He said, there's this thing they do in Africa that's like throwing bones or something. And I was like, what? You know, because I've never even heard of that. But then, of course, I Google, you know, throwing bones, and there it is. And I read about it, and I was like, ooh, this is pretty cool. And since I believe in the book, he has bones back there anyway, it was easy to make that transition. And I rewrote the scene, and I used it, and I thought I added that Claire knew what it was because she had traveled with Uncle Lamb, who's a archaeologist or anthropologist, and so she had traveled to these places and she knew about it. So it wasn't like she was this wide-eyed, you know, newbie. She was like, I've heard of this, I've seen it. And then they do the throwing of the bones. And of course, I don't think this was in the book where, you know, he tells her Frank is well and you will see him again. We added that because we want to show, and of course we've shown more of Frank than is in the book, because we've always wanted her to have more of a love triangle and show, just round out Frank a little more, show why she loved him and where she came from in her history, so that it informs her and Jamie. And to show that she does, you know, she did love Frank and she's worried and concerned about him. And, you know, she loves Jamie. Obviously she's with Jamie now, but that doesn't mean she doesn't care about someone that she did used to care about very much. And so, you know, we thought it was nice that she was concerned about Frank and that he's on her mind, and she's never been able to tell anyone that. She can't even tell Jamie that, because it probably hurt his feelings that she was wrapped up in worrying about, you know, her ex-husband. But Raymond is the only person in the world that she can say, and I purposely wrote it that she says, I'm worried about a friend. And then Master Raymond says, what's his name? Because he knows it's a man. And then when he says, like, oh, don't worry, you'll see him again. And she's like, huh? And, of course, the audience has seen that this was a foreshadowing, because, indeed, she does see him again. We saw it in the premiere of the season that she's back with Frank. So that was just a little Easter egg that, you know, we put in there for you guys. And it's just a fleeting moment, but it really says a lot.
Well, besides what Master Raymond says, there were quite a number of clocks in this episode. So lots of allusions to time.
That wasn't on purpose. we didn't have a clock theme going. But, you know, the cuckoo clock is something that I took. It's one of those parts of the book where you love it in the book and you think, oh, ironically, the cuckoo clock was from a later chapter in the book, and that script had already been written, and I knew we weren't using the cuckoo clock from that particular section of the book. And the original draft of the script, I had scripted because Louise has this pet monkey, and when we were researching, we saw that there were portraits made back then of the ladies and lords of the house holding their pets, their little dogs or birds or whatever their pets were. There's a lot of portraiture of that. And I thought, oh, wouldn't it be great if Louise was having a portrait painted with her monkey? And so I'd written a scene where she's holding the monkey and there's some crazy French artist painting her, kind of yelling at her and being like, hold still, I can't get the paint, you know, I can't do the painting right because you're moving. And of course, it's very hard to hold a monkey. And that Claire comes upon this scene and it's just crazy, you know, and that the monkey ends up jumping out of Louise's arms and gets loose and runs around the house, and Louise bursts into tears. And then Claire thinks she's crying about the monkey and is like, don't worry, we'll catch her, you know, we'll find her. She's probably under the sofa or something. And then Louise ends up confessing that she's not upset about the monkey. She's upset about, you know, finding out she's pregnant with her lover's child. So that was originally the setup. But of course, that first draft script went to Scotland, where our wonderful producer, David Brown, read it and was like, just send me an email with one line that said, monkey stays in the cage. Because it truly would have been a nightmare on the set to try to have a wild animal you know, with the actress holding an animal and it jump out of her arms and run around the set. That would have taken 3 days to shoot. So they told me, basically, you got to change that. It's fun, but no. And I was like, yeah, I didn't think I could get away with it. So actually, that's when I remembered, you know, I needed some kind of ruse for Louise to get Claire over to the house, because she's called her and said, I need to speak to you. It's urgent. And she couldn't, you know, you didn't want to just have her walk in and go, hey, I'm pregnant. You wanted some kind of, you know, mislead at the top of the scene. And that's where I decided to pull the cuckoo clock from the other section and go, hey, cuckoo clocks were just starting to be invented. Wouldn't it be cool if she had one of the first cuckoo clocks in Paris? And that's why she calls Claire over. And then we have Claire go, a cuckoo clock? Is that really? Is that what you called me all the way over here? You said it was urgent, you know. And that's how the cuckoo clock came to be. And actually, when I first, you know, had read in the book, I pictured one of the, you know, how cuckoo clocks look today, the heavy wooden German Bavarian ones that, you know, the Swiss Chalet type or whatever they call them. There's a name for them, but that's not what they look like back then. The very first cuckoo clocks looked like what we have in our show. And Gina, our wonderful, you know, set decorator, Gary built this beautiful room, and then Gina went and had the clock made specially for this scene. And they showed us pictures of it before it was made, and we're like, that's fantastic. We love it. And it was actually the same prop makers, I heard later, who made the watch that I love so much in my watch episode from last season. We've got this group of really talented people that whenever we need a unique prop like that, they go to them, and they're the ones that make it. So the clock was fantastic, and my hats are off to them for the watch and the cuckoo clock.
A lot has been said since episode one. And I'm pretty sure since it's been going through three episodes now, and it's kind of become a hallmark. A drinking game now. The prince's use of Mark Me.
Yeah, I believe it was Ira Bear that first came up with that phrase, because I believe he was the first one to write scenes with the prince. I think the prince first appears in episode two. So Ira sort of set the tone for the prince and how he talks, and he came up with that sort of the catchphrase because it sounded very arrogant. Mark me, you know, and then we all just sort of picked up on it and started using it whenever the prince had a speech, to have it just be sort of his little calling card that he used. It's in episode four, and I'm sure it's not the last time he says it. I think he says it all the way through. I think he says it literally all the way through the season, but we thought it was funny, and he was an interesting character to cast because he's Scottish, but he wasn't raised in Scotland. In fact, the real Bonnie Prince had never even been to Scotland when he came to mount the rebellion, because, of course, his father, King James, was exiled and went to live in Italy. So Charles was actually born in Italy and raised in the Vatican, because the Pope is the one, because he was a Catholic, James was a Catholic king, the Pope took him in. So Charles was raised in Italy and spoke fluent Italian. And, you know, when we went to cast him, we're like, should this guy have an Italian accent? That's going to sound really weird if Prince Charlie has an Italian accent. And then we decided, no, you know, his parents weren't Italian and he was around his parents the most. So he wouldn't, you know, even though he's raised in Italy, he'd probably talk more like his parents. But he does have a little bit of oddness because he's sort of a mixed European, you know, as opposed to just a Scot or an Italian. And Andrew Gower, that's why we chose him. He had the right mix in his personality and his mannerisms of being kind of this oddball who really wasn't one, you know, culture or nationality than the other. He was sort of a hybrid. And that's why I hope the audience got this. I think it's a little hard to track that he's an exiled prince, so he is from a different country, and that's why I had Sandringham make these jokes about the Pope and sort of talk about the Pope at the dinner party, because we knew that that's something that would really bother Charles to have sort of the Pope and Rome be talked about this way by this British sort of pompous guy, and that he would take umbrage at it and be like insulted, highly insulted. And that's why it was so fun to play that sequence, because he's, you know, Sandringham's mouthing off about the Pope, and Charlie's like, hey, that's my pal, you know. don't talk that way about him, but he was a fun character to write, and he was based on a real historical character, so we had a lot of fun researching that whole part of the Jacobite history. It was really tragic and really interesting, and we hope that we portray it. We know that he comes off a little bit, you know, of a character, this ill-fated character, because he had both sides to him. He was a really smart guy, a really well-intentioned guy. He really wanted to help the Scottish people. He really was charismatic and magnanimous and generous, and he had all good intentions, and we never mean to belittle him. But at the same time, the rebellion failed because he was a flawed person and because he didn't have the skills and the experience necessary to pull off something like this. He bit off more than he could chew. And he was truly a tragic figure. And to this day, people still revere him, and they should, because his intentions were good. But we wanted to show the real man, not, you know, and every hero and every person in history, whether it be American history, even our own presidents and our own, you know, our own American royalty, they're all very flawed. And so, you know, we wanted to be fair and show both sides of the man. And I hope that we did that justice, because we really wanted to do justice to what the real, you know, history was for Scotland.
I'm sure it will continue to be such, but yeah, thus far he's been very convincing as that historical figure. So at the end of the episode, and indeed in the book after the dinner scene when it goes to hell in a handbasket, when Mary's on the stairs and comes down and all that mess ensues, in the books it is kind of a free-for-all. It goes crazy. And mm-hmm. I thought it was well represented in the... I know it's the adaptation. It's different, but quite chaotic and kind of a free-for-all in the fighting in every direction at the end of the dinner party once Alex is discovered on top of Mary.
Right.
What were... Either as you were breaking the episodes down before you went off to write, what was the group's intention and... or your intention for how that kind of just went from focusing on one thing and people freaking out to, like, fighting in every direction?
Well, we always knew we would have a big brawl like it was in the book, and we called it the brawl scene. But we always did know, and Ron especially said, this can't be a real fight. This can't be a fight to the death, because, let's face it, Jamie and Murtaugh could take all those guys out in about 30 seconds. You know, these are trained Scottish fighters, and they're a bunch of French guys that go to dinner parties. You know, these are not fighters. Even the general, he's got a sword, but he's an older guy. And Murtaugh and Jamie could have just killed them all in 2 seconds. So we didn't want it to be that kind of a real fight, because Jamie couldn't kill anyone or seriously hurt anyone. It would have derailed their whole plan to stop the rebellion. You know, if he had murdered, you know, a general or even these high society people, and it would have exposed Prince Charles, and anything that he did to cast a bad light on Prince Charles would have really, in not the way that he wanted, it would have derailed their plan. So we always talked about how to walk that fine line between the brawl being, you know, sort of serious enough, but yet and not too serious where you think someone's actually going to die or get a sword put through them. So the concept we kind of came up with was to do a sort of Three Musketeers kind of fighting, where it's humorous, but not comical would be the wrong word, but just a lighter kind of fighting where... And it was easy to accomplish because, after all, everyone was supposed to be very drunk. So everyone overreacts, and everyone, you know, it's like, this is ridiculous. Come on, guys. And it's just one of those boys will be boys. Everyone's kind of posturing and bravado and losing their cool. And in essentially, like, you know, we started the brawl by, we have a great stunt man, Dominic, who comes in and choreographs all of our fights for us, from the very serious ones in the battle sequences or the ambush sequences to, you know, this party brawl. And basically we just went into the parlor and we said, don't let Gary Steele anywhere near, because he's going to have a heart attack. But what we have to do is walk into the parlor and go look around and go, what can we break? What can we throw? And so we just took the actors in there, and the director and I, went in there and we went, what can we mess up in here? And we came up with everything from, you know, knocking the couch over to breaking a lamp or an end table or the sashes off of the curtains. And I believe we even maybe went and looked at a couple of fight sequences in the Three Musketeers movies to get the tone, you know, not the exact moves, but the tone. And what Ron liked about it is he always likes fights to be realistic in that, you know, people are out of breath, or when someone gets hurt, knocked down, they're really knocked down. They don't just pop back up. And so we were looking for realism plus a lighthearted tone to it, which was a hard line to walk. But, you know, it had to just end on this fun kind of, we didn't want there to be real danger. We just wanted it to be like, oh my God, we meticulously planned this whole thing and everything that could go wrong went wrong. And look where we are now. And now the Comte is leaving with the Prince Sandringham. You know, they accomplished their purpose in that they got Sandringham out of there and they got him to see that the Prince wasn't worth investing in. But now, you know, the cliffhanger is there's an even bigger problem because the Comte has got his hooks into the Prince and we don't want that to happen. And we really always plan to end with, and the script does end with, Fergus at the table. We wanted to end with this big brawl's happening and Fergus slips in and drinks the wine and eats a big turkey leg. Although we were told there are no turkeys in Scotland, so we can't have a turkey leg. And I'm like, a lamb shank or a rib chop, whatever, you know. We want to end on this Fergus so that we end on this kind of lighthearted note. But I believe it was the network that really, they said, we love the Fergus thing, but we really want to end on Claire's face and her realizing, oh my God, everything's gone to hell in a handbasket here. And the party is now the nightmare dinner party that, you know, that we never planned. And so we did go off of Claire, but we got Fergus in there. And that's something, you know. Now you'll have to watch next week to see what the new developments are, but it was kind of a fun end to a more serious, you know, episode that was more serious in the middle, but just leaving you with, you know, kind of like, be careful what you wish for, because this dinner party, all the planning that went into it, sometimes you just can't predict.
I did see somebody post online today. Somebody took the fight scene and put the Benny Hill soundtrack behind it. And sped it up just a little bit, and it actually worked quite well.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah, that's very funny. That's funny. Yeah, we had a lot of fun with it. Enjoy it. So there's some episodes coming that are not so fun. We try to make each one its own little movie in a way, and that's one thing I really love about the show. It's not the episodes the same. They're you know, lighthearted ones. There's sad ones. There's ones that are, you know, you can have something as whimsical as The Search, you know, in season one, and something like Rent, you know, up against like The Witch Trial and The Wedding. They're all their own little thing. There's no two that are alike, you know. Each week you get treated to a whole different tone and a whole different flavor and facet of these people and this world. And each writer has their own style. You know, in most series, the role of the showrunner is to, you know, once the writers write their episodes, the showrunner takes a pass and rewrites every episode to, quote, bring it in line with their vision. So, like, you know, you could have 10 different writers on an Aaron Sorkin on West Wing, but when Aaron Sorkin puts it through his typewriter, they all sound like Aaron Sorkin. They all sound like West Wing. And that's the goal of a lot of network TV, is to make them all sound the same. And in Outlander, you know, they're all Diana Gabaldon originally, but every book she writes and every chapter she writes is very, very different. She has a wide range. And Ron, I think that's part of what his genius is that he lets us all write what our strengths are. So we have people that are good at writing sad stuff, or people that are humor, that are, you know, Angus and Rupert, people that write battle episodes, people that write, I mean, we can all do all of it because we're all, you know, veteran writers who have a lot of experience, but each person gravitates to an episode that they feel that they can bring something to. And then Ron, sometimes even if he does a light rewrite on an episode, his goal is not to make everything his voice or everything Diana's voice. He definitely gives us ideas. He definitely steers the ship. He's definitely the captain. But he lets each episode, writer's voice shine through, and each episode is its own little gem. So you've got emeralds and rubies and sapphires. You don't just have moonstones, you know, for 13 episodes. And I think that would make Outlander a show I would watch every week, even if I wasn't writing on it. And so I feel very lucky.
And so do we, not just that our favorite series has come to life, but that we've had the opportunity to speak with you twice and that you've been so kind as to join us again. And
sure.
We love hearing, of course, anything from kind of behind the scenes or about the development of the show, and to be able to speak with a writer who not only adapted it, developed it, was there for the episode, for the filming, for the creation, you know, just from the process. And then, of course, culminating with Ron doing your guys's podcast episode. So much fun, such a delight. And did I hear you correct? This is your favorite book of the series thus far?
So far. And I haven't read all the books, though. When Ron hired us, I think, and I've said this before in interviews, that he basically, two of us had read all of the books and been like longtime fans, and two of us had never read the books and didn't know anything about them at all. And of course, you know, when we read them, we fell in love with them. But he asked us sort of, or I don't know if he asked or just we decided sort of it was an unspoken thing that the two of us who hadn't read them were not going to read ahead. Because if you read ahead, you know what's coming, and it influences.
Absolutely.
If you know these two people are going to fall in love, or if you know they're going to get married, or if you know this person's going to die, if you know that that's happening down the road, it's going to influence how you write. So I purposely don't read ahead. So I've only just recently read, book three in anticipation of, hopefully our pickup. But I have not read Drums or anything past that. And so I can't say it's that Dragonfly is my favorite of the whole of all eight books, but and I of course loved Outlander. You know, book one is of course very special because it started everything.
Yeah.
But I loved Dragonfly. And I'd have to say I'd probably heard more people say that they love Voyager. I guess because it just kind of goes to more places. It's more of a
adventurous,
I don't know. It travels.
Yeah.
It's an adventure, and it's fabulous. I mean, I just read it, I loved it. But for me, my personal taste, I really dug France, and I dug the intrigue of the court and the king, and I like the politics and the romantic politics and the relationship and what Claire and Jamie went through. I'm more into that emotional, mental gamesmanship for a story than, say, the more action adventure type of stories. That's the kind of writer that I am, just have done more of that. But there's definitely people on our staff that the opposite is true. They're more the adventure types, and so there's people that are just dying to get into Voyager, and I think Voyager's going to be a fantastic season, and, but it'll be very different, and it'll keep everybody on their toes. So, yeah, it's going to be awesome.
So, if there's a season three pickup, will you be fighting for the print shop scene?
Oh, well, I think it goes without saying.
Okay,
but,
so,
there is no... There is probably no Voyager without the print shop, but that is a long ways off.
Yes,
and
yes.
Whoever writes that episode will, we're not going to always deliver everything exactly like it is in the book, because we don't want you guys to get, we don't want it to be predictable and everybody that has read the books to go, I know exactly what's coming. So I'm sure we'll do some version of that, but I'm sure that it will be delivered in the Ron Moore and the way that our staff pulls it together, and whoever writes that episode, you'll get their version of that, and it will no doubt surprise you and delight you.
And so if it's not you that is delivered through, it'll be someone that you had to fight, right? Or who had to fight you?
In a
hypothetical universe where we get picked up and we have Voyager, without saying what happens in that scene, if it's something that you would like, then I'm guessing here it would be you or someone that had to fight you for it.
Well, the brawl, to use our word that we yeah. just used, the brawl over those episodes hasn't really gelled yet. But when I read the books, I did have a favorite section that might surprise you. That is, I would say, a more quiet section that is something that is not an obvious choice. I tend to gravitate towards something that's a more dark horse choice, I would say.
Yummy. I can't wait. if we get it, I have to stop talking
or I'll be killed.
No. If it's hypothetical.
It's like if I told you, I'd have to kill you.
Exactly.
So, but yeah. But you won't be disappointed. Whatever we do, every single writer on our staff puts their heart and soul into every single thing we do. Nobody phones it in. Nobody goes, you know, nobody thinks of it as a job. Everybody has a great, great love for these stories. And I've never seen a more dedicated group of writers and never had the pleasure of working with such great people, talented people and nice people and passionate people. So I never worry about what the future holds because I know that whatever it is, this team of people will make it great, you know.
And as you continue to read, and you've said that regardless of the show, you've read book three, and still Dragonfly is your favorite, at least till now. My wish or my benediction is may it always remain your favorite, even when you get to number 8 or number 10. Because now I
can't even imagine number 8.
I'm
constantly like astounded that that Diana is so prolific, because you know it's the same people I know. And to find that many stories to tell for that long is astounding. And God bless her, because she's given plenty of material for all of us. And I hope she keeps writing. I know I've heard that she plans to keep writing and that she's writing even now as we speak. And so it's like, keep going, lady, because we'll be right behind you. And every bit of it that we can bring to the screen and do it justice, then we will.
Oh, from your lips to God's ears, and may we get, as we say, this hashtag, all the books.
Well, thank you so much, and thank you guys, and thanks to all the fans. It means a huge amount of to us when we hear that you appreciate what we do. It's really, we don't take it for granted at all.
And we do appreciate absolutely everything. We know that we're very lucky that our not just our Summer and I, but the fans' beloved stories are in, quite frankly, I think the best possible group of hands.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you so much.
So thank you, Tony, so much for joining us, and have a wonderful rest of your week. And hopefully when whichever episodes are yours, when they air, you'll have continued parties with friends.
I try to.
Yeah.
I try to. Yeah, it's fun. It's fun. It's a good Saturday night. It's a good way to spend a Saturday night.
That is true. Outlander, that's a new tagline. Outlander is a great way to spend a Saturday night. Okay, Tony. Well, thank you so much for your time and for joining us again. It really means a lot to us.
All right. Thank you, guys. Take care.
You too.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Slanja.
Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/outlanderpod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at @outlanderpod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/outlanderpod, or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.